Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to the creators of Just Married, the musical. Right now, we're going to hear an interview that I actually recorded yesterday at the Dragonfly School. I'm delighted now to welcome Nancy Woodward. She is the director of the Dragonfly School, which is a school for small children ages 3 to 8. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
So you started this school 3 years ago. It's a school in Santa Fe, and I thought we could have a conversation about early childhood education. Why did you start the school?
The school that I was teaching at was closing, and some of the parents who didn't have places for their children to go the next year were interested in starting a school. So they asked the preschool director, Stephanie Smith, who was teaching in the preschool classroom at the previous school, and I, if we would help them start a school. And we needed jobs, and we it was interesting to start a school. Stephanie and I both had we had a vision of what we thought a school should look like, and we had never taught at that school, and it was the opportunity to create that school.
What were some of the components of that vision that you thought a school should look like?
Stephanie and I are both real constructivists in terms of our educational philosophy, which means we think hands-on learning is a way to engage children and a way for them to be excited about what they are learning, because they're controlling the variables. And many schools do some hands-on learning, but they don't sort of really embrace it throughout the curriculum. And it's very easy to do things in a 3- and 4-year-old, a preschool classroom, that are operational activities. But to sustain that through 6th grade, which is our goal, is a challenge, because people see hands-on learning as not being academic. And there are ways to report and collect data and use hands-on learning to be academic. But it's a challenge. And most curriculums aren't designed to do that with older children. However, Piaget, who's one of my educational heroes, said that most children from the 3-year-old through elementary age were at that concrete operational learning place, and that you develop abstract reasoning out of doing operational things. So if we want children to really be able to be logical thinkers, we need to provide a place for them to really experience their
so
own.
So what's an example? I mean, when you say that, I think you learn the abstract thinking of geometrical proofs through having played with blocks and strings and things like that. Is that the kind of thing you mean?
Yeah. Or you learn how to make words out of learning the sounds and the shapes of the letters and writing what you want to write. You learn to read by reading what you have written, even if it's misspelled, because you can sound it out, because you know that that shape makes a s sound or a p or a whatever. So you write and then you read back. And you have a real interest in what you're writing about, because it's what you know, your story.
But you also use children's books.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we definitely use children's books. We have 3- and 4-year-olds writing stories. We have 5-year-olds writing stories. I mean, we have our multi-level 1st, 2nd, 3rd grade class writes books. And by the time they're writing books, they're actually checking to see how words are really spelled. They have a word wall on the which are the words they're using in their room, so they can say, oh, that's how to spell the word I want. And it's important to us that they learn how to spell words, but it's more important to us that they want to write. So it's that kind of continuum.
It seems like there's a trend toward college preparation and preparation for success and things like that at a very early age, and it makes me worry that kids are having to turn into little students before they're ready to do so.
I know. If you look at what public education looks like in Northern European countries, you'll see that they're much more relaxed about when children read, when children start to do numbers on paper, than we are. And yet their students, more of their students go to college, more of their students finish high school, more of their students complete an academic program. So while there's reason to be concerned about how we're doing education in this country, because so many of our kids don't even get through high school, I think the focus on testing and accountability at really young ages really put structures in place that cause children to lose their interest in learning.
You structure your school according with the developmental abilities and needs of the child. So what developmental stage are, for example, three-year-olds at, and how do you meet that in the preschool course that you have?
There are two ways we look at kids, and one is where they are on the social-emotional spectrum. And we like three-year-olds to be moving past the egocentric stage of the very young child so that they can share, so that they can cooperate, so that they can recognize the needs and feelings of another child.
Now, before that, when you say they're in an egocentric stage, that's just natural. They can't not be that way.
That's right. You know, an infant, and I have a grandson, and this is so cool to watch, is in what's considered a sensory motor development stage, which means that they're just figuring out the operating system for their body. You know, oh, I have a hand. Look, I can move the hand, that kind of stuff. And then from there, they, you know, the normal course of development is considered that the child develops language, and you have the little tyrant two-year-old where everything is mine and my world centers around me and people should do what I say immediately. I want food, you know, and food appears. But the next thing that happens is the child begins to see outside themselves and, you know, be interested in how things work. Not just, you know, having toys and, you know, playing with toys, but actually how does this happen? You know, if I put the rock on the board, the end of the board goes up. Well, I put a rock on the other end and, you know, I make a seesaw or whatever. You know, they begin to really test their world. And that's considered by Piaget the pre-operational stage, where they begin to extend into exploring the world in a more thoughtful way. They create their own experiments. And at the same time, they're developing a social-emotional skills. So, and there was a Russian educational theorist named Vygotsky who said that that was actually how we grew intellectually, was through our social-emotional interactions. And Piaget is on the opposite side. He says we learn by testing and, you know, building our concept of reality one test at a time. So I think both are important. And Stephanie also thinks both are important. That's one of the reasons why, you know, we can make a school together, is because we're including both of these things in our environment. We use a program called Second Step, which teaches children emotional intelligence and nonviolent communication skills. And whenever there's a problem from anywhere in the school, you know, we encourage the people who are involved, and it can be adults as well as children, to identify their needs, their feelings, and what the outcome they want. And it's really lovely to see three-year-olds catch on to that and solve problems for themselves. And similarly, we want to have a play environment where there are all kinds of possibilities for putting things together, taking things apart, building, acting out. You know, children have such rich imaginary worlds, and just a little costume box can lead into what at the preschool age, girls do a lot of princess play, and boys do a lot of superhero play. And there are researchers who have, you know, worked out that that's really important in the child developing a sense of right and wrong, a sense of generosity, a sense of charity, whatever. I mean, the girls who are being princesses are learning to be, they're learning to be generous beings, you know, because the princess is good and kind and saves everyone. That's the good princess. And similarly, the little superheroes are out, you know, saving the world for mankind. And that's important for them to experience.
During the feminist movement of the 60s and 70s and beyond, there have been people who've tried to suppress the gender roles kind of play that come out in school. From what you're saying, it sounds more like it's just natural and it's something that you have to let them do.
That's certainly how we see it. You know, and that's not just in gender roles. You know, it's sort of like if a child has an interest in something, it's really important to support them doing it in a safe way, and exploring it, because that's the longer I go as an educator, I really think people know what they need to learn, and it's my job to help them learn those things and to find the materials or create the environment or support that work, so that we own our own learning. Because as long as we're going along owning our own learning, we're going to be lifelong learners.
One of the things that when I was here before visiting the Dragonfly School, we're talking to the Dragonfly School director, Nancy Woodward, was that you had a whole setup for ancient people, and you were making moccasins and the accoutrements of, what was it, ancient New Mexican people?
Yeah, the students in the elementary class are learning about ancient people, and it's part of a PNM grant about how we use energy. So their question is, how did ancient people, acquire energy? How did they use energy? How did they improve their lives through, fire and light and tools? And so we've had a whole group of visiting archaeologists who have done things with this class. They've made clay lamps and gathered moss to use for wicks, and we used lard from the grocery store to melt to use in the lamp, because we weren't going to go out and kill an animal so that we would render animal fat like the ancient people did. But the kids understood that we were skipping a step. They've made digging sticks. They are going to plant in our garden using their digging sticks later this spring. They've made their gathering bags, because they're a little tribe of hunter-gatherers. There's a imaginative part of this thing where they've told their story as Ice Age people, and they have written their story as Ice Age people, and they understand, that they needed to kill the woolly mammoth, and they had a plan to kill the woolly mammoth. They built atlatls, and we made a big target. We measured a target that was the size of a small woolly mammoth and painted it on a piece of sheet, and then they practiced throwing their atlatls.
What's an atlatl?
An atlatl is a tool created by the hunter-gatherer people to throw a spear with more power. And it's really a simple hinge device that fits on your arm and allows you to direct and throw a spear. And it uses the principle of the lever to put more force behind it. So we also had a conversation about simple machines, and we'll develop that simple machines curriculum next year with this group. But
one of the things I find fascinating about the way you were teaching that particular set of classes was you started out asking the kids, what do you want to learn about ancient people? Then you do the whole set of classes, and then at the end, you go back to the questions that they came up with. So it's very much of an interactive process. It's not just the teacher is feeding them the curriculum.
That's right, because if they determine what they want to learn, and what they wanted to learn first was, what are the animals that lived at that time? And their first work was learning posters, and they each chose an animal, the saber-toothed cat or the woolly mammoth, or they're animals that are extinct that we only have fossil evidence for. But they did research, and they made their posters. And then they incorporated that into the play they wrote about their tribe.
One of the, you can't even call it a problem, but one of the manifestations of being a little kid is that sometimes it's hard to focus, and then sometimes kids really concentrate and focus beautifully on the things they're doing if they're interested. How do you observe what makes, and how do you use what you know about what makes kids able to actually focus on their lessons?
Well, one of the things that we're all interested in is Howard Gardner's stages of intelligence there, and he's identified at least eight different kinds of intelligence, and we look at which kinds of learners we have in a group. And there's also a human dynamics system which looks at whether people are emotional, mental, or physical learners.
Can you be all those things?
Yeah, and you could be totally balanced across each of those spectrums. You could have equal numbers of indicators for all the eight intelligences, or emotional, you could be a balanced emotional, mental, physical person. Most of us aren't. So you'll find that someone who's a kinesthetic learner on Gardner's scale is more of a physical learner on the in the human dynamic system. That makes sense. However, that child or adult needs a lot the ability to move around when they're learning. So we have to think about how to make time in the classroom for that to happen if we have a child who's really on the physical learning scale.
I'm going to be interviewing next week the people who teach the classes called Cooking with Kids in the public schools, and it's the same kind of thing. They've found that kids who have a hard time sitting still at desks flourish in an environment where they're chopping vegetables and learning in that way.
Yeah. So, you know, if we can use manipulatives in our math program so that they have even things to move around on the table to, you know, help them work with their sense of number, they're going to focus on math better than if they just had a pencil and a piece of paper. Because it doesn't take a lot of motion for a kinesthetic learner to move or to engage. But the ability to have something, you know, really works well for that person. Similarly, if you have the person who's the more emotional and interactive, so the emotional learner is your interactive and introspective person on Gardner's intelligence scale. There's so many correlations between different people's ideas about how we learn. They will do better if there's a story around their learning that involves people in some way. And so, you know, this ancient people's curriculum that we're doing, you know, has been a real place for those people who created the storyline about this tribe to flourish and be engaged, whereas the addle-addle throwers are those physical people.
So you've got all these different kinds of learners. How do you make it work for all of them?
One of the things that I really treasure about Molly, who is teaching that multi-level class, is that it's important for her for the kids to be a team. And they talk about what it means to be a team and how to accommodate, and not just accommodate, but, you know, treasure and utilize the skills of each member of the team. So when they do a project, they sort of sketch out, you know, how to use each person's gifts and then work with that. And we can do that because that's a small class. You know, right now our teacher-student ratio in the school is pretty much 1-7. It's a little over that. And as we get older kids, it'll grow higher. But with those kinds of numbers, there really is space to honor each individual and their learning style.
So how do you teach science?
Well, that's my personal specialty. And it grew out of my own love of the natural world and my observation of my own sons that they were always making explanations for how things worked, and they were observing things all the time. And sometimes the story they put together for why things had worked, you know, was right on, and sometimes it was very interesting, but didn't have a correlation with at least what scientists think is, you know, how things work. So I had the real privilege during the years I taught at another private school, when I was hired to teach hands-on science and hadn't worked with 4- and 5-year-olds doing that, to figure out what they were interested in and how to make a curriculum around that. So with the younger people, something they have a great fascination with are bugs. And in the fall, there's lots of bugs out there to collect. So then we collect bugs and we look at the parts of bugs. And the Earth's Birthday Project has these enormous beetles you can order so that you can see a really big bug and its parts and realize that the little ant that you have under the magnifying glass has the same parts. And then we build bugs. And we're really into recycled materials here. So we, you know, have a collections of stuff that kids can take what they want, and as long as their bug has a head, an abdomen, and a thorax, and those are in the wrong order, and 6 legs and antenna, you know, they can use anything out of the box to build a bug. And then I ask the kids which bugs do they really want to learn about the life of, and we have a whole game we created about the life cycle of ants, where the kids make the classroom into tunnels, and, you know, by taking tables and sheets and whatever. And we draw sticks, and someone's the queen, and these different people are the males, and these are the workers, and the workers have different jobs, and they know that some of them gather food, and some of them take, in the case of the seed-gathering ants, they have to take the husks off the seeds, and they feed the babies, and there are other ones who take the eggs and take them to the nursery from the queen, and there's this whole little colony. And then, you know, after a round of it, we draw sticks and everybody plays again. And we actually had to play that until everybody got to be the queen, because that was how they wanted to do it.
So when you get to an older age group, first, second, third, fourth grade, where does the science go from there?
This year we've been doing soil and geology. And we started out by gathering soil samples in the garden. And another thing that we do here with all the classes is garden. We grow food, and we gather the food, and we cook the food, and we compost all of our waste from the school. So our garden didn't do so well last year, and part of it was it didn't get enough water. But my question for the elementary science class this year was it our soil as well? So we took soil samples, and we shook them in jars of water, and we looked at the soil was composed of, and we tested for acidity with litmus strips. And we now have a plan to build better soil in the garden this spring. So after we did soil for a while, we noticed we had a lot of rocks in our garden, we have progressed to, you know, where do rocks come from? What are the different kinds of rocks? We're really lucky we have the Santa Fe River that flows right by our school, and the river is a really sandy environment, and there's lots of gravel bed fans after the river runs, and you can look at how, you know, conglomerate rock, for example, was made, because you've got sand and pebbles and different sized rocks all mixed together. Most of our kids have been to the ocean. They've been on beaches. So we've gathered sand and other soils and shook them in, again, water jars, and looked at how sediments develop. And kids have such a fascination with volcanoes that we've looked at the different, what we understand the inside of the earth to look like, how a volcano happens. The two earthquakes that have happened in the last month have really just fed right into this curriculum, and how the earthquake has moved the continental plates of the earth. And I have to take a step backwards and say that this class also, before they became ancient people, looked at how the earth had formed. And they made globes and they made tectonic plates. So that was happening while we were studying soil, but that's then fed into our idea about geology and the plates floating on the Tauriasinosphere, which is the rock that's magma. It's fluid rock, and that's what comes out in the volcano. And so we've moved into modeling how different kinds of rocks are made, where they are in our planet, and, you know, what they're useful for, because then the volcanoes made flint, and the ancient people needed flint for their spear tips or chert or other, you know, the metamorphic rocks that are hard, that come from the volcano pushing the other rocks around and heating them up. And there are these ways where things keep circling together in terms of useful ideas.
And you're very much outdoors as well as indoors.
Yeah. When we started, and this sort, I worked for Outward Bound Schools when I got out of college, and I worked for an Outward Bound Adaptive Program. So it was only settling down and having my own family that got me involved in education indoors. And I knew from Outward Bound, you know, that hands-on learning was really what I was interested in. When we started Dragonfly, there was another group of people in New Mexico forming something called the No Child Left Inside Coalition. And we became charter members of that because I really wanted the kids in our school to have experience hiking, camping, being in the natural world, both in structured ways, you know, us going on a hike, and unstructured ways where they could be in a wilder environment in a safe way. They had a space where they had to be, a meadow, and they could make up their game, whatever it was, and with it, their friends. And we've been able to do that because we're right next to the river. We can go there anytime we want to, and we have a plan to go on hikes or, you know, expeditions into the mountains on Fridays when the weather's good, and sometimes when the weather's not so good. Our parents have been very tolerant of supporting, you know, us with, you know, good outdoor clothes for the kids. And there's actual research that shows that children who spend more time in the natural world are better able to focus. Getting back to your question about focus earlier, that's one of the reasons children are, you know, or why we have more what's considered attention deficit disorder, is that children are not getting enough time and don't have a relationship with the natural world. So we certainly are, you know, involved in, you know, getting kids outdoors. And I think our families also are people who spend a lot of time outdoors, too. So, and that's one of the reasons they're interested in the school.
We're talking to Nancy Woodward, director of the Dragonfly School. What do you do when there are the inevitable conflicts that come up when you've got children of any age hitting each other, yelling at each other, that kind of thing?
Well, it depends upon whether people are physically safe. Because if there's physical safety isn't happening, you know, in terms of someone actually, you know, being hit or hitting or a, you know, real fight breaking out, our first job is to make it safe, which means we, you know, separate the children. And because we have younger children, you know, we're adults and we're strong enough to do that. And then those kids need to cool off and get in touch with their feelings. So we give them some time and space, and they begin to know the protocol. You know, how do you feel and what do you need? And what do you need from the other person? How does the other person feel?
You know, so a kid just hit another kid and you separate them and then you say, how do you feel and how did the other kid feel?
Well, it sort of depends upon what happened. Because of our low teacher-student ratio, we can actually, you know, a teacher will take on the job. And all of our teachers have skills in mediating disputes. So if, you know, if someone's hurt, the first thing is to actually get an ice pack for someone's boo-boo. And then you go from there. You want to stabilize that person and get them comfortable because they're not going to be able to speak their needs until they feel they've quit crying or, you know, those things have calmed down. So it may take a while. And often people are brought from the playground to my office if it's one of those things where there's more hurt going on. If it's on the playground, the teachers who are out there will take care of it. If it's in the classroom, it depends upon what else is going on. But my office is a safe space for kids to solve problems. And, you know, we talk about what happened and we talk about how to fix it. And, you know, what does it look like to own your own feelings and needs? And that's the first step. And sometimes if a child can't figure out what's going on for them, we ask the other person in the dispute, well, what do you think is happening for that person? And then that the other child can help them, you know, figure out what's going on.
Now, over the course of, let's say, a school year, when you have a kid who's been acting out, do you see that child calming down through using the methods that you use?
I think so. That's certainly not true for all kids. But over time, I've seen a lot of children take responsibility for their feelings. And we also support this with a curriculum called Second Step that Santa Fe Public Schools supports us in having, which is an emotional intelligence learning program. And there are puppets, there are games, there are songs, there are pictures of feelings, there are all levels of learning about what it is to be an emotional feeling person in the world, that outside of the fray of feeling those feelings. And the kids love this curriculum because it's, you know, they all have feelings and they all want to talk about a time when they were mad or a time when they were sad or a time when they were really happy. And we progress into more complicated feelings like disgusted and disgruntled and anxious. What are those more sort of fine shades of meaning and feeling? So in addition to working with things when it actually happens, we work, you know, in the calm of you know, the classroom. And it's part of our literacy work to identify, write, act out feelings.
Well, another thing that you are teaching is politeness, respectfulness, patience, and things like that. And those things are skills just like math skills.
Absolutely. And I think we have a culture that models a lot of disrespect. So it's really important to work with being respectful and the benefits of being respectful in terms of getting along as a team or as a class or as a school, that when we're respectful people, things actually work more smoothly.
Sometimes in a classroom, a leader will emerge, and sometimes that person is a positive leader, and sometimes they are a negative leader, leading kids to to act out, and then other kids start doing it. What do you do in those situations?
Well, usually we stop and try to look at what's going on. What are the needs here? And is it a time that we can meet those needs? And
An example.
In one of my science classes, I cannot remember what the funny word was, but we were talking about plant parts, and one of the students, without holding up her hand, started riffing on the plant parts and making funny sounds, and other people joined her. And I sort of just got really quiet and watched what was happening.
Pistol, I bet it was.
That's a good one. Sticky stigma. So everybody is laughing or participating in being ridiculous at this point. And I just stopped teaching, and after a while, some of the kids said, "We want to have science." And I said, I tried to get kids, everybody, to get quiet for a minute. I said, "Do we want to have science class today? Because I can't teach when you're doing this." And some of the kids said, "Yeah, we want to go back and, because they knew that there were flowers to take apart on the table." So, we talked about who had been doing what and what needed to stop and change. And we got down to the people who had started following the person who started being silly. And we've talked about being a negative leader and a negative follower before. And sometimes that's enough to stop the what's going on. Sometimes we just need to get up and, move with this and make sounds, silly sounds. Because it's kind of hard when you're outnumbered by silliness and when you're trying to teach. And these are five-year-olds.
Yeah, I mean, I remember being in first grade, and that happened, and we were in a huge class with only one teacher. And when that happened, we would stop everything, move the desks, and we would actually do the hokey pokey.
Yeah, I mean, you need to
and
do something. Yeah, I mean, I really appreciate that I'm teaching science at the end of their day, and they have probably by that time some unmet wiggle needs.
Right.
I can stop, and we can go outside and look for signs of spring. I mean, there are lots of things that can happen with that. But we really do, when someone, like the child who said, "I really would rather do science," I go, "Thanks for being a positive leader."
Right.
Because we need people to take responsibility. I mean, the other thing with that class is we have them on a token reward system now because this became a serious problem.
What's a token reward system?
In this case, their names are on a list on the wall, and when anyone is doing something right, and this works best when there's the teacher and the assistant in the classroom, they get a check for, sitting quietly in circle, listening, helping a friend, singing well as opposed to singing raucously. There are so many ways to earn a check, but it's all for doing it right. And the teachers notice what's going on that's right.
So it's the opposite of a demerit system.
Yeah, you try to ignore the other behaviors and go, "Thank you for putting your lunch away and pushing your chair back under the table."
What are the longer-term goals for this school? Right now you're preschool through, what is it, third grade?
Third grade this year. It's our goal to be a full elementary school in the next couple years. And I'm really excited that we have fourth and fifth grade students, families who are contacting the school right now because it's re-enrollment time. And it's looking like in addition to carrying that class of first, second, third graders forward and breaking it into a first, second, and a third, fourth class, that, we'll actually have some fifth graders joining that and some more fourth graders. Because when we get to be an older group, then we'll be able to go on what are called learning expeditions. And that means you actually go on road trips to flesh out a curriculum. New Mexico has amazing roadside geology. We have lovely historic sites with interpretive materials through the State Parks Department. We have the national, monuments and national parks, Mesa Verde and Chaco Canyon and Canyon de Chelly. And we just live in a rich place where you can actually go and see. And that's, I think, really cements and connects to so much that we're trying to do here within the school, that being able to extend the learning in that direction is going to be really huge for those kids who get to do that. Similarly, I want children to go on longer camping trips. Right now we do an overnight camping trip in the spring, and as we get older, we'll do one in the fall and then a longer trip in the spring. But when we have fifth and sixth graders, we could do very sheltered kind of backpacking trips. And that would be a lot of fun to do, because I think so much of what we will have learned about the natural world in our science classes then will be something we can go into more in depth once we're up in the mountains.
Nancy Woodward is the director of the Dragonfly School. They're on the web at dragonflyschool.com. If people want to find out more, how can they reach you?
The school phone number is 995-9869.
995-9869. Nancy Woodward, thanks so much for being with us.
This has been fun, Mary Charlotte. Thank you for having me on.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'm very happy now to welcome John Arterton and James Mack. They are musicians. They are the creators of the show Just Married, the musical, which is going to be here this coming weekend, Saturday and Sunday, at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you. Great to be here. And you pronounced my name right.
Well, good.
My name is not usually a problem.
Arterton and Mack. So the two of you married when you were based in Massachusetts, and when Massachusetts actually legalized same-sex couplehood, you got married, and as you put it, the sky didn't fall.
Exactly. We got married in April 2005, and among many thousands of couples across Massachusetts who are now happily wed to each other. And indeed, the sky has not fallen, although the sky has been raining here for days.
Well, in fact, Massachusetts has one of the lowest divorce rates in the country. So the sky hasn't fallen, and there are a lot of happily married couples here.
It's interesting, because one of the things that I think is a kind of false argument in the whole liberal and conservative conversation about marriage and same-sex couplehood and whatever, is mm-hmm. that in liberal states and blue states, couples seem to stay married longer and in a more stable manner.
Well, of course, we've had the right to do so for a very short time, so time will tell, but it's amazing how many couples who have been together for 30, 40 years have finally had the right to become married, and so of course they're stable. But we should also say that though we are legally married in Massachusetts, the federal government does not recognize, thanks to the so-called Defense of Marriage Act, the federal government does not see our marriage as being legal. So we are denied about 1,200 rights and privileges that are afforded to heterosexual couples that are married. Even though we live in a state where it's allowed and so forth, we still denied all of those federal privileges.
So you can file jointly in Massachusetts but not in the U.S. for tax purposes, for example.
Exactly.
That's correct.
Exactly. Yep. And if we travel to another state, we have no rights of, you know, visitation in a hospital for family members, and we're not afforded the right to pass on Social Security benefits from one partner to another, and so forth. The list goes on and on.
So tell us about Just Married, the musical. How did this come about?
Well, James and I met singing in a choir, and we both have sung all of our lives, and we have had the opportunity to sing a song or two in various fundraising capacities, and we love doing it. And when the whole marriage issue seemed to be prevalent in our lives, we just decided to put a show together. We call it Just Married the Musical, but in fact it's a musical review and not an original musical. We do songs from other sources, some of our favorite songs, and we just put them together, and then we interwove some dialogue with it, and the dialogue and the songs are a combination of humorous, political, and I guess what you'd call moving.
What are some of the songs that you do that people might know?
Well, we do We do some show tunes. We do some more traditional love songs. We do a song from the movie Moulin Rouge, which is a song that we sang in our wedding to each other, called Come What May. We do I do a Stephen Sondheim song in the show called Children Will Listen, that's from Into the Woods.
We do a song from The Fantastics called They Were You.
Yeah.
And we do a number of original songs by modern composers. And it's really a wide variety of different musical styles.
Now this show has, you've been touring it, and it's been very successful.
We haven't toured a great deal. We have very busy lives outside of this. James runs a guest house here in Provincetown, which is out at the very end of Cape Cod. And luckily that closes for about 3 months in the midwinter, so we're able to do more touring at that point. And I have three choruses that I conduct. So our lives are not... plus, I was on the road with another musical group for a full decade, so I've lived that life, and I've looked at life from both sides now. And I really have no desire to be on the road full time anymore.
But that being said, we have done the show quite a bit. We the first 2 years that we performed the show, we did it here in Provincetown for full summer seasons, which meant 2, 3, sometimes 4 or 5 nights a week performing the show here in Provincetown. We have traveled with it to Hawaii. We did last year for Valentine's Day. We did the show in Boise, Idaho, to a very enthusiastic and very receptive crowd. We were happy to see. We've done the show a lot in the Northeast, in Maine and in Connecticut. You know, and
we'll be going to D.C. next month,
right?
And of course, D.C. just legalized. Instead of saying same-sex marriage all the time, we like to say marriage equality.
Right.
It makes people less nervous, I think.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And points out that we're really not asking for anything that other people do not enjoy. We simply want to be treated the same way as everybody else. If I can just jump in with another thread here... One of the main arguments we hear against same-sex marriage is that marriage is an institution that has changed, and why are we trying to rewrite history and so forth? To which we point out that in 1957 there were many states that did not allow people of different races to marry. So,
and they did use, I think, some of the arguments they used sounded very similar to what they're using now.
Yes.
Right, that's true.
Yeah.
So marriage has evolved. I mean, back in King Solomon's time and during the biblical time, you know, kings would have hundreds of wives, and that was perfectly okay back then. That's frowned on in most of the country now, most of the world.
And even in the early days of the United States, women were considered their husband's property. So women were not allowed to write legal documents, to own property, that kind of thing.
So how is the movement for same-sex marriage, for marriage equality, doing across the country now? Is this something you're following?
We follow it here and there. It's, you know, we long for the day when this might actually be handled on a national level, so that the battle does not have to be waged in individual states, because it's very exhausting. It's very spotty, you know. It's frequently, you know, there are two courses of action. There's the judicial and the legislative, and the legislative road is very thorny. We even saw in Maine recently the populace voting against same-sex marriage. So in Massachusetts, it was the Supreme Judicial Court of the state of Massachusetts that made the ruling. And obviously after that, there was a great outcry from the opposition, and they tried to get referendum placed on the ballot, and they actually won the first round of that, and then there was a statute that said that the proposal had to come up against a constitutional amendment in Massachusetts a year later. And during the course of that time, so many of the politicians who had voted against same-sex marriage changed their mind. In fact, some of the people who wrote the legislation decided that they had been in error, and they changed their mind, seeing that the sky hadn't fallen,
right.
and so the constitutional amendment failed.
And in most cases, it was because they actually knew couples who had been married. They'd gotten to know people who, you know, gay couples that had been married, and that's how their minds were changed. You know, and we find that that's what happens all the time, is that once people actually know gay couples that are married, and they see, oh, gee, they're not so different. You know, they're just like us. They just are two people that love each other. Then the fear is gone. The mystique of the whole thing is gone. And so we try to expose as many people as we can to our story, just our personal story, so people can understand what same-sex marriage really is about.
I was talking to a friend just before I went on the show, and he said, oh, then they're going to have the same stupid problems that the rest of us have.
We want right to divorce each other.
Exactly. Yeah, we do have the same stupid problems.
John Arterton and James Mack are the creators of the musical Just Married the Musical, and that will be performed this Saturday and Sunday, March 20th and 21st at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Santa Fe at 107 West Barcelona Road. For more information, you can call 577-8018 in the area code 505. John and James, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features Artist of the Month, Horace Silver. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will be with you tomorrow just after 8 o'clock, and Robert Knott will be with us, speaking of the arts, and Bill Hutchison will be with us, speaking of animals. Hasta mañana. Ciao.